First case on our calendar is 06305 Carol Selmer versus Robert J. Rogers et al. Mr. Leek.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Doug Leek, and I'm here on behalf of Dr. Edward Walker, Dr. Han Su Shin, and Radiology Associates of Warren. And I would like to reserve 5 minutes rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Thank you. We request that this court reverse the 11th District's decision in which it misinterpreted Evidence Rule 601D as it relates to the qualifications of an expert witness. Specifically, both the 11th District and the trial court misinterpreted Evidence Rule 601D and ignored the plain language of that rule relating to the qualifications of an expert witness. In this case, plaintiff's expert, Dr. J. Thompson, was not qualified under Evidence Rule 601D because at the time of trial, he was not engaged in the active practice of clinical medicine. He admitted on the stand that he was no longer practicing clinical medicine. He was not doing anything that was adjunctive to patient care. And in fact, he admitted that he was only seeking out employment so he can regain his competency to testify. And that is the very type of witness that should have been excluded, someone that is trying to be a professional witness.
He was just one question on the facts. I took it from the appellee's brief that he was already working again, but I take it from your brief and what you just said, he was not yet working. Is that right?
That's correct. It was his intention. He had signed up with an organization to get trained on a computer on interpreting radiology films. So he had not yet been engaged in the clinical practice of medicine, and his only intention was to do this so he could be qualified under Evidence Rule 601D.
Well, counsel, had he retired from the practice of medicine?
Well, he had moved to Florida, so there was some debate as to whether or not he was officially retired. But yes, he had moved.
So he went down there and he spent 7 months so he could be qualified for income tax and estate tax purposes as a Florida resident. But he came back to Ohio and was now working for another firm.
No,
right?
It wasn't like he was going to work for a radiology facility. He was going to do locus tenens, which is where he could be hired around the country, and specifically admitted that.
Like radiologists in Pakistan and India do, right?
Well, correct. I mean,
right.
But the thing is, he had not yet done that, and.
Well, he was in training, wasn't he, for that at the time?
I think there was still some debate as to whether or not he had yet commenced his training, but he had come back to sign up, and he had gotten employment, but he had not yet started.
Is it true that he had actually been employed by your firm during the same time period that's in dispute to prepare to serve as an expert witness in a couple of cases for your firm?
Our understanding is that he was not doing so in medical malpractice cases, which does not apply, which would have applied Evidence Rule 601D. His other practice of being a professional witness was also in asbestos, and he may have been retained on an asbestos-related case. But this is a medical malpractice case in which Evidence Rule 601D applies. And it is clear that the drafters of Evidence Rule 601D meant that this rule, evidentiary rule, was supposed to be in the present tense.
Mr. Leek, let me ask a different form of question. Does it make any difference in this case that the trial date had been moved, I think, two or three times at your request, and that had those requests not been made, this witness would have qualified at the time of trial?
Under Evidence Rule 601D, it does not make a difference at the time of trial.
All right, but it is true that had you not requested a trial continuance, this expert witness would have been able to testify at trial. Am I correct about that?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so the reason for application of 601D is due at least in part to a continuance that the court granted at your request to accommodate your client or yourself.
Correct. And that's the issue about Evidence Rule 601D as it stands in the state of Ohio. As we have presented to this court in our brief are the examples of the evidentiary rules virtually identical in other states that can address that specific issue. We don't have that under Evidence Rule 601D. Those other states intended that the rule be applied in the past, whether it be the expert was practicing within 1 year of the alleged negligence, 3 years, 5 years. Those states intended to apply to issues just like that. And Ohio does not have that.
Counsel.
Mr. Leek.
Go ahead.
Mr. Leek, 601D, since we're talking about that, you're saying it is in the present tense.
Yes.
No question about that. But it doesn't say unless at the time of trial the expert is licensed to practice, et cetera. So you would have us read in to 601D that phrase, would you not?
I'm not asking you to read into it that they were required to say at the time of trial. What we're asking the court to do is to recognize the plain language of the words devotes in the present tense to the active clinical practice of medicine present tense, and also to take in conjunction that there's the requirement that the physician be licensed in the present tense. So,
well, counsel, that's following up on Justice Lansinger, that's exactly where I wanted to go to the rule. He was licensed at the time of trial.
Yes, no doubt.
And the rule says he is licensed, so that requires that in the present tense. And then it says, unless he devotes at least one half of his professional time to the active practice of medicine.
Correct.
Well, he had no professional time while he was in Florida.
Correct.
He was on vacation.
Correct.
Or whatever he was fishing, presumably.
Correct.
And as I read the discussion of the rule, that part of it is expressly designed to keep you from getting people, as maybe even you said in the brief, who are just hired guns. All they're doing is testifying in court. So his professional time leading up to the time that he went fishing or house hunting or whatever he was doing in Florida was at least 50% devoted to the active clinical practice, was it not?
Well, that's the thing is, it's supposed to be active.
I mean, you're not claiming that his professional time is suddenly more than 50% devoted to testifying.
Well, we're saying that this is the kind of witness that is intended to be prohibited, where he has no professional time to the active practice of clinical medicine and admitted that he was only doing so to get this job to be a witness. And the scenario I can also give you is, hypothetically, you could have a witness, if you take the plaintiff's argument, that was qualified at the time of the alleged negligence, who retires and then completely retires, and then 5 years later testifies at a trial and is a professional witness and testifies, all I do is testify as a witness. Well, here's a person that's a professional witness, but under the plaintiff's interpretation, the erroneous interpretation of evidence rule 601D, would be qualified because 5 years earlier was engaged in the active practice.
Isn't this doc, in fact, just the very kind of person that one would look to, for example, when you had the problem this patient had, to get a second opinion? I mean, he's fresh, he's taught, he's examined thousands of these kinds of mammograms
But that's where you run into the problem of those particular people becoming professional witness. The Ratliff case that we cited, Ratliff versus Stewart.
But he wasn't a professional witness. He had not been until the time he went fishing. He did some testifying. But he did, his principal work was doing exactly what he was hired to do here, and that is look at these x-rays and mammograms for people.
But he by the time he testified, when you look at what he was doing at the time he testified, he had been done that. And yes, he was down in Florida, and you can interpret that as being retired or being on a prolonged vacation, but once you take it to the next step. Once he admits that I am coming back to be employed just to be qualified as a witness, that then tells you that this is a person that we don't want testifying as a professional witness.
Well, that you don't want testifying. Yeah, I mean, you're trying to take a very small snapshot in time and say we can ignore his entire career. He's coming back, he's receiving training in the latest technology. This is going to be the modern way that people read these things. They sit at home by the pool and look at these things if you're in his business. That's the way of the world now, and he's getting that training.
The way we look at it is we have to look at Evidence Rule 601D and enforce it under its plain and ambiguous language as it exists in Ohio. We don't.
Well, you're using the imperial we here. You're really asking this court to give a hyper-technical reading of the rule, are you not?
No, we are asking this court to read the unambiguous language of the present tense. There is another forum in which the drafters of the evidentiary rules can amend the rule and then adopt a rule similar to Georgia or Virginia or New Jersey.
Let me interrupt. Isn't the issue for us, the rule clearly is written in the present tense.
Yes.
And when the Supreme Court adopted this rule, it didn't anticipate the situation. And the question is whether we want to read into the rule to make it account for all the things that Justice, probably the policy sorts of things that are being talked about here, or do we apply the rule as it's written? It's clearly present tense. I mean, there's a gap here in the rule, it seems. And do we close the gap through our usual rule amending process, or do we close the gap in an opinion in this case? That's the legal issue for us.
That is the legal issue.
Why should we not close the gap in an opinion in a case instead of waiting for our rulemaking process to do that if it's needed?
That is exactly the legal issue before this court.
Well, counsel, would it make any difference?
Have an answer to my question, maybe.
You are exactly correct on that point. This rule, the way it's written, is in the present tense. Had the drafters intended this to apply back in the time of the alleged negligence by saying you had to be qualified at the time active clinical practice of medicine, the drafters would have included that. We have presented you with states that have said those specific words. We have also presented those evidentiary rules, identical, virtually identical to this, that have said you had to be engaged in the active clinical practice within 1 year or 3 years or 5 years.
Right, but yes. My question is, what's wrong with us making the change in the application of the rule in a case versus changing the rule through the rulemaking process? This would be a pretty easy case for us to just say, well, the rule says present tense, but it looks like the rule kind of missed this point, and so we're gonna just change it. We're gonna apply it differently to make it seem more fair, if that's the right
term. It is our position that your role is to enforce a plain and ambiguous evidentiary rule, and the proper form is to draft an amendment if this is unjust or untenable. A perfect analogy is recently that this court repealed Evidentiary Rule 706 dealing with learned treatises, and then adopted Evidentiary Rule 803.18 of the federal rule. That was a perfect example. We had years and years of cases trying to interpret the use of learned treatises at the time of trial. This court did not change Evidentiary Rule 706 in its decisions. It enforced the clear and ambiguous language of Evidentiary Rule 706, then repealed it, and then enacted Evidentiary Rule 803.18. That is the perfect analogy of what this court should do in this case. If there is a problem, if this is unjust under these circumstances, the proper form is to amend the rule. But here, this form, it is necessary to enforce the rule, and it is the present tense. And he had to be qualified at the time of trial, devotes and active, clear and ambiguous.
Just O'Connor has a question.
Yes.
Thank you for your answer.
Thank you, Chief. We wouldn't be talking here if the testimony was that he had taken a 7-month hiatus for whatever reason in Florida and was coming back to join an active practice.
I think there would have to be more testimony from Dr. Thompson to establish that he was back and retrained and in the active practice of clinical medicine.
Why retrained? Why would he need to be retrained?
Well, let me apply it to the facts of Dr. Thompson. He was being retrained in computer.
Well, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about if he had left his former radiology practice, took a 7-month hiatus anywhere, and then decided to either return to his original group practice or join another group practice, we wouldn't be talking here, right?
You are correct. And
so your only objection is the fact that he came back and his chosen focus of using his medical degree was to secure training and then become, quote, a professional witness.
Exactly. And that's why fact-specific on the enforcement of the rule is that he was not qualified.
And I understand that. Now, related to what the Chief Act asked about how this court effectively closes the gap in this this process, you know, is it practical, desirable, or even fair to afford the hyper-technical interpretation of this rule in the general scheme of things, how patients are treated and how patients address the issues that are present in this case in a court of law?
And I think that's why we're before this court, because over the years between the 2nd District and the 11th District versus the 9th District, which we're relying upon in the Lovejoy case, is that there has been misinterpretations of an evidentiary rule that should not have been interpreted. It should have been enforced because it's plain and unambiguous. And that's why we're not asking for a hyper-technical interpretation. It's a clear, plain, and ambiguous evidentiary rule that should be enforced under the present tense to these facts of the case of a witness who admitted that he was only regaining employment to be a professional witness. So both from a factual standpoint, he's not qualified, and an enforcement of this rule should have prohibited him from testifying. And I see that I've run out of time, and I ask that we enforce this rule in the present tense and find that Dr. Thompson was not qualified at the time of trial and should have resulted in a directed verdict. So we ask that you reverse the jury verdict accordingly.
Thank you, Mr. Leake.
Thank you.
Mr. Moses.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Norm Moses. I'm here on behalf of the Selma family and the Appalese. I would like to start off by saying that we request, obviously, that you affirm the 11th District's ruling in this case. I don't believe, as Mr. Leake mentioned, that this rule is something that should be literally interpreted. I believe that the rule is designed to make sure that physicians that testify in these cases have the expertise necessary to testify against physicians or in support of physicians. How does one become an expert? One becomes an expert by having years of experience in the field they seek to judge. And that's what Rule 601D is designed to do. It doesn't make sense that if you interpret in the present sense that qualified experts will necessarily testify. I believe if you look at the intent behind the evidentiary rule, you have to give some leeway to permit the trial courts to determine who in fact has the experience to testify in this case. And that's why for a long time here in Ohio that the admission or exclusion of a witness to serve as an expert in the case has been within the sound discretion of the trial court, because these cases are so fact intensive that one case may present a very compelling set of facts, such as in this case, to permit an expert to testify. But in another case, even though somebody satisfies a quote-unquote strict interpretation of the rule, that person clearly does not have the expertise to testify.
Counsel, what was his employment status at the time of trial?
Your Honor, he had come back from Florida in April, had accepted a job with a locum tenens radiology group. What that group does is they take trained radiologists and other physicians and they place them in other facilities, such as perhaps an off-site radiology group where they read MRIs and CT scans. He was actually in the process of receiving computer training, which now is kind of what they do. They send these overseas by computer and they get interpretations. So he was learning a new skill in radiology to permit him to continue to practice. And I would like to clear up one thing.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, stop you right there. Was his training going to be used exclusively to be an expert witness, or was it to read radiology images for other physicians and then report or diagnose what was seen on the image, report back to the doctor so the doctor then can devise the appropriate treatment for the patient?
That's exactly what he was training to do, is to read films in the usual course of medical practice in support of other physicians who were in
those
studies.
And his sole reason for going, as my understanding is based on the argument here today, was he was only going back to be an expert witness, a hired gun. That's not true?
I don't believe that's true. I think what happens is the whole hired gun professional witness, that's kind of what the 50% rule was designed to do, is make sure that somebody that's not out there treating patients, not out there involved in medical care and treatment, not testify against people that are doing that. And if somebody satisfies the rule, their motivation for satisfying the rule, I think, is a subject for cross-examination and goes to their credibility and the weight to give to their testimony. I don't think if somebody spends 100% of their time in the practice of medicine and they do that so they can go out and have a lucrative practice testifying, I don't think that you can exclude that witness from testifying, but I think certainly that gives rise to some good points on cross-examination. And that was, in fact, in the trial transcript at the time of trial, that was brought out. All these issues that we're talking to factually before the court today were raised on cross-examination. So I think it goes to weight.
Mr. Moses, if, in fact, it was on cross-examination, is there anywhere in the record a documentation of the provisions of Rule 601D that says that this person devotes at least one half of his professional time to the active clinical practice in his field of licensure?
At trial?
Let me clarify what I'm asking you. What is the status of the evidence with respect to whether or not this expert witness devotes one half of his professional time to the active clinical practice?
At the time of trial,
At the time of what's in the record is what I'm looking at.
I have the pages cited in my brief, Your Honor. I don't have them committed to memory. I apologize, but I know that there was some citations and discussion in the appellee's brief regarding the testimony that Dr. Thompson provided on the actual 601D requirements.
And what does that show?
That shows that he was employed, he had accepted the position with locum tenens, that he was receiving training and had planned to be placed.
Accepting a position and being employed doesn't quite meet the prerequisites of the rule to demonstrate one half of a professional time. That's what I'm asking you. Is there a place you can point me that says this is the evidence with respect to that finding?
I don't think the quote-unquote buzzwords were used, the 50% of his time were used as of the time that he was sitting on the witness stand. I think the only testimony that we have in the record is that he was employed and that he was receiving training. Now, how many hours per day, I don't know, but I would submit that that was his only professional time was learning that. So I would be making a reasonable inference based on his testimony because he wasn't otherwise employed. So I would take the reasonable inference from his testimony that all of his professional time was in the pursuit of his profession and training therein.
But clearly, up until the point he went to Florida, he had been engaged in the full-time practice of medicine. And at the time he was retained and through several of the continuances and the stay put on during the, was it a bankruptcy or a liquidation, he was still full-time employed. And so that's where we look at the inequities in this case, in that he was employed during the time you retained him, he met all the requirements during the time the trial was supposed to be held, and but for the continuance, he fell in this gap. And that's what we really have to struggle with in terms of the literal interpretation that the other side wants versus a fair interpretation that really seems to apply to this case.
And I certainly agree with that, Your Honor. I think that the rule proposed or the interpretation proposed by appellants would lead to some very untenable results. This case it probably presents the most compelling circumstances that illustrate that. But another situation would be, let's take it from the defense perspective, that they have an expert that is one of the world's best, and they've been practicing for 30 years in one of the top institutions in America. And the plaintiff files a 41A as at their luxury. The defense expert qualified during the whole first filing of the case, that he was deposed, gave testimony, the case was dismissed, plaintiff waits a year, refiles, brings it, there's a expert discovery cutoff, and up, let's say, 3 weeks before trial, the defense expert retires. The defense can't 41A the case. The defense is past the expert discovery cutoff. He may or may not file a motion to continue with the court that the trial court, within its discretion, may not grant. So
the defense could, though, have a deposition and use the deposition, because it says testify person giving expert testimony, which oftentimes, as you know, is done in a deposition. Here we had a deposition, but the doctor also testified, so we don't have that issue. But that would be one solution, would it not be? Or another would be to have a different expert, as you could have gotten a different expert, maybe.
Well, I think that those questions illustrate the same problem, is when is testimony? Is it the time of a videotape deposition? Is it the time of a discovery deposition?
Well, I would think that a person giving expert testimony on the issue of liability in a claim and testifying is like, it would seem to me if you take the deposition, and as you know better than I, oftentimes that's the testimony because the doctor doesn't want to appear at the trial. That's the testimony. And it would seem to me that's when you determine whether the doctor complies with the rule.
And I would also say that during a discovery deposition, the opposing counsel would be questioning and perhaps may not satisfy what the defense would do on direct examination. But I would also say that if a party has to continually guarantee at some point in the future that their expert is going to satisfy the rule, it would place an impossible burden on every litigant. And there's no, you know, I could certainly tell at the time that I retain an expert whether or not they satisfy the rule. I could tell at the time of deposition whether or not they satisfy the rule. But an arbitrary date set sometime in the future that is sometimes a continuous, as in this case, is beyond my control.
Counsel, let me take you back to the facts again to make sure that we're clear on what is and is not in the record. Prior to his hiatus in Florida, is there any dispute that more than 50% of his professional time was devoted to the active clinical practice of medicine?
There was no dispute whatsoever, Your Honor.
Now, with respect to his reengagement or his new engagement, because he severed his ties when he went to Florida with his the folks with whom he had been affiliated with, and in the time he was in Florida, would it be fair to say he didn't have any professional time?
Correct.
So there was a hiatus in his professional time. He comes back to Ohio, and his professional time is devoted to, in the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to the trial, to education, not re-education, but education on a new means of reading these tests.
Correct.
Essentially, so he can read them off-site.
Yes, exactly.
Then he testified, the opposing counsel keeps emphasizing that he said, well, he wanted to make sure that he's still qualified to be a hired gun, to be an expert witness. Is it unfair of us to conclude that he understands what's required under the rule to do that? That is, that more than 50% of his professional time has to be in the active clinical practice.
I think that's a matter for cross-examination. I think if somebody knows the rule, I think that's certainly fair game.
I mean, if one says, I re-engage so I can be, couldn't you presume that he understands I have to devote more than 50% of my time? I can't testify 100% of the time that I have to. My professional time has to be more than 50% in the active clinical practice.
You certainly could presume that. I would also say that he was under the mistaken impression, however, that he needed to do that for the asbestos work where he serves as a defense witness.
Which is what he thought he was setting up to do, is it read these
correct
tests more than 50% of his time, and then he would be okay to be a That was apparently most of his testimony time was related to those kinds of cases.
Correct. And I would like to emphasize that there's no evidence in this case at any level that he was a hired gun in medical malpractice cases. This expert, and no one has claimed, appellants have never claimed, that he was not qualified to interpret mammograms, which were at issue in this case. He had interpreted over 150,000 mammograms. This is the type of expert that we would look for to assist the jury, and that's really the bottom line. was he qualified and competent to assist the trier of fact in whether or not these physicians met the standard of care and interpretation of a mammogram. And I think that's really what the rule's designed to do. And our trial court, in this case, did a wonderful job in looking at all of the facts that were unique to this case and saying that Dr. Thompson clearly is a qualified expert to read these mammograms, and due to no fault of the Selmers, he would have met this rule, a strict interpretation of the rule. At any previous time, had the case been tried on one of the first two trial dates, and there was no stay of proceedings.
But counsel, looking at the language of the rule, the appellant is relying in part on the Lovejoy case.
Yes.
In that case, as the Chief Justice is focused on the language, the person giving expert testimony, that court seemed to look at that as the time in which we see the qualifications of the witness. And the rule is there for trial judges to make a determination of a witness competency. So shouldn't we look at that language as saying, this is a present tense, everybody agrees to that the trial judge looks at when that person is giving testimony and determines if that person is in active clinical practice at that time?
Well, with all due respect to the Ninth District, I think that ruling was very troublesome and probably incorrect, just simply because of the application of the law. If you take that strict interpretation, what is actively practicing? At the time a witness is on the witness stand, are they actively practicing? If you really want to take it to the extreme, does it have to be one day before testimony? Does it have to be a week before testimony? What if the expert is from Chicago, let's say, and he has family in Ohio and decides to take a month off to spend with his family? Then he could come here and testify. Does he fit the role? And I think that if you take that strict interpretation of it, we can come up with a lot of scenarios that
except the rule says, counsel, unless the person devotes at least one half of his or her professional time. So devotes is a little different than, yeah, I practice. I'm going to leave here and go see a patient this afternoon. That's really not what the rule means.
Right. And picking up on that, what is the rule designed to do is to make sure that witness has the experience to testify in a medical malpractice case.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked counsel for the appellant, that I think there's no question the rule is written in the present tense.
Correct.
And it's maybe hyper-technical, but when the court adopted the rule, it appears that if it considered these kinds of issues, that you don't see it in the rule. And the question, it seems to me, for us is to decide whether we want to apply the rule with a sense of equity here, or say the trial court had the authority to do that, but to not say that the rule means that you can go back to the date of the injury or the onset or whatever, or should we leave those kinds of conditions and considerations to our rulemaking process?
I think this court is in the best position to close the gap, because I don't think any rule can be written in a way that will anticipate all of these fine areas, all of these gray areas that come up in these types of cases where you're dealing with experts. And I think in situations, a trial court has to be entrusted with the discretion to decide whether or not an expert is truly qualified to testify in a case. And I think that's what it really comes down to. And I think reinforcing the law in Ohio, the trial courts have the discretion, and assuming they exercise that in a sound manner, they can exclude or permit experts to testify in these cases. And I think in this case, under the set of those facts, the trial court exercised their discretion in a very sound manner. I think the 11th Appellate District affirmed rightfully.
Thank you, Mr. Moses.
Thank you.
Mr. Leek, you've used your time. It may take 30 seconds.
We have spoken about facts in this case. We would not be here if evidentiary rule 601D was drafted like those other states, Virginia within 1 year of the alleged negligence.
Counsel, I think we all understand that we had the option of looking at other states, chose what was chosen, and that's what's on the page. Let me ask you, if the plaintiff had utilized the video deposition of this physician that was taken while he was engaged in the active practice, and the continuances occurred, and he was in Florida at the time the trial occurred, would you be arguing that he could not, that the video deposition would be precluded from use?
And I think the Chief Justice brought that up very clearly, that it does read at the time of testimony. So if you use that.
I'm asking what your position would have been at that time.
If you use a trial video and you qualify someone at that time, that's what we do in trial videos. We qualify them at the time. So under the reading of the plain and ambiguous language of Evidence Rule 601D, if you're talking about trial testimony in present tense, it is at the time of that trial video.
Well, does it say at the time of the trial video, or does it say at the time of trial?
I think that's what the Chief Justice was talking about. It uses the word testimony. And so if you take a plain meaning of that part, which is not an issue here, it does say testimony.
The word trial is not used in the rule.
No, I know.
It's testimony. Mm-hmm. That's your.
We use that usually when we call depositions trial depositions or trial videos.
Yeah, but
it does say at the time
of
testimony.
My point was that earlier was that giving expert testimony can be given in a deposition, which is then used as the testimony in trial. So that's the date at which the date that the doctor gives his testimony, his or her testimony, in the deposition would be the date we would look to, is it not?
And I think that's consistent with the evidentiary rule as it's written in the present tense, that when you have the opportunity to cross-examine a witness in the present, and you know they have to be qualified at that time, and that's why our rule, the way it's written, is in the present tense and not in the past. And the trial court and the 11th District relied upon the Crosswhite case out of the 2nd District that created an interpretation that this rule is directly concerned with the past. Well, there's nothing to suggest that. And the Lovejoy case out of the 9th District looked at the words and the phrases and the grammar and the common usage of those words. And that's what we must do, is enforce that rule here. And there's another forum. If we want to be consistent with those other states that put in those time requirements in the past of within 1 year or at the time of the alleged negligence, that is in our rulemaking process as I compared it to the learned treatises that we did recently did in Ohio.
Well, even if we say that the rule is present tense, there still is an area of discretion for the trial court, is there not? As the appellee, I think, suggests, is that somebody still has to make the decision whether this expert is devoting at least one half of his or her time to the clinical practice. And that's a question of that's a really a factual question, is it not, which we generally leave to the trial court to make.
And as was asked by Justice O'Donnell, the record does not establish that he was practicing at least 50% of his time to the clinical practice of medicine. I mean, it is clear that he had intended to come back and intended to take on some training and intended to take on some work to be a witness. That had not yet occurred at the time of his testimony in the present tense at the time of trial. And we believe that the trial court in the 11th District's interpretation of the rule was erroneous, and that it should have enforced the rule to the facts of this case and excluded Dr. Thompson. So once again, we ask that you reverse the jury verdict and would essentially result in a directed verdict because they had no expert on standard of care.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.